This is Radio Reorient, part of Network Reorient, a podcast arm of the Critical Muslim Studies Project. We aim to explore the post-Western and reconnect the Islamosphere. Welcome, listeners, old and new, to another episode of continuing Season 10. Inshallah, we'll be starting Season 11 in February. It has been almost 3 months since the latest phase of the war on Palestine. During this time, we have seen the relentless bombing of Gaza and the widening of violence against Palestinians and their supporters. Since I've last spoke to you, South Africa has brought charges of genocide against Tel Aviv at the International Court of Justice. This has been endorsed by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, as well as the individual nations of Malaysia and Turkey. We have also seen the resupply of Tel Aviv by the US, with the President of the US using an executive order to bypass Congress to ensure this resupply actually got through. Now, activists have designated 13th of January as the Global Day of Action for Palestine. There will be demonstrations occurring on this date all around the world. In this episode, I, his Amir, sit with Salman Said to discuss why Gaza matters. Our discussion ranges from reasons for Western government support for Israel, how the attack on Gaza has shown the limits of the nation-state model, amongst other models, and the meaning behind the concept of the Palestinization of Muslims and how this can be resisted. Let's listen in. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Radio Reorient, where I am joined by Professor Salman Said, and we'll be discussing the situation in Gaza. So, Professor Said, I want to first ask perhaps a question that's got an obvious answer, but I should probably ask it anyway. Why are Israeli actions in Gaza receiving so much support from Western governments in particular?
This is maybe an obvious question, but it's also a very difficult one. Two things. Firstly, I'm not sure that the governments of many countries in the global north, not all, are aware that they're doing anything different than what they've done in the past. So to some extent, this is a continuation of what has been a long-standing policy, or what they perceive to be a long-standing policy. When we talk about governments, we often forget we're talking about people who probably don't have the kind of institutional memory that goes back beyond electoral cycles, for example. So they're not necessarily aware. And then you have a certain kind of mythology that through which it's refracted what they understand of the past. So that's the first point. Why they're supporting it is partly to do with the way in which the war on terror and the institution of global Islamophobia has worked itself into the sinews of governance in much of the global north. So the identification for them when it comes to Islamistan and the Muslim communities general is that it is divided between moderates and extremists. And the moderates are basically wannabe Westerners, but are prevented from being so by the threat of violence from the extremists. So it's very, very clear in this Manichaean world which cowboys wear the white hats and which cowboys wear the black hats. What they don't understand is the identification between the Palestinians and indigenous peoples, which actually betrays this kind of Manichaean vision where this division between right and wrong is encased within their own imagination. So that's the first thing. So I think one has to understand that there is an identification with Tel Aviv, which has many aspects to it. cultural aspects to it, social aspects, etc. But these aspects are not automatic, but are a construction of the consequence of the Zionist project, which has articulated Judaism and Jewishness as being part of the Western patrimony. And there are many examples that one can go to. One can go to the Theodor Herzl's various attempts to rearticulate that. But in general, the idea that Tel Aviv is a European outpost in the heart of Asia. You can see the recent attempts to see and articulate Tel Aviv as a white ethnostate, which requires the reconfiguration of Jewishness as whiteness and then locked into white supremacy. And one of the ways you can see this is how, for example, the racist, explicitly racist political parties and groupings and ideologies, which were traditionally, conventionally, extremely anti-Semitic, are now still anti-Semitic, but their anti-Semitic is articulated with pro-Zionism. And, you know, so it's a kind of a, and you can, you know, if you think about the people who are supporting Tel Aviv's rampage in Gaza, many of them are, you know, beyond the normal pale of what was considered to be post-1945 political spectrum within the global north. So there is these kind of ideological affinities. And this is where Islamophobia comes into play, because basically everyone in Gaza is considered to be a terrorist or a potential terrorist, leaving aside how you what that term actually means. As a signifier, it floats around within the context of 20 years of the war on terror, and it's clear identification between Muslimness and terrorism. And you see that being replayed in different registers. So, and you can see one example of this is look at the way in which so-called mainstream news organizations report the war. They normally headline it as the Israel-Hamas war. Or rather than Israel-Palestine or Israel-Gaza. So you have basically Israel fighting Hamas, even though the majority of the people killed have been children or and women. But the kind of notion of who constitutes Hamas is flexible. And in the hands of spokesmen from Tel Aviv, it becomes even more fungible. Anyone who disagrees with them is either a Hamas sympathizer or a Hamas fighter, regardless. So that's that kind of context. So what you've seen a convergence at a kind of philosophical level between the commitment to the preservation of whiteness and the rearticulation of Tel Aviv as an element of whiteness. And that has plays itself out very, very differently and in domestically in many places. And one of the things you will see is now the kind of assault on the gains of civil rights as, you know, however problematically managed through policies around equality, diversity, inclusion. So that's one, and I think that's the key kind of element. And then, of course, there is this that beyond that, there's a certain kind of practical embedment in terms of relationships that people have built up between different kind of groups, the way that they see themselves reflected in this picture that Tel Aviv presents itself as this Western society on the shores of Asia. And that's very, very similar to the kind of playbook of every kind of European colonial settlement, whether it was in Algeria or in Kenya or in South Africa or elsewhere. That these, well, we are Europeans, we are fighting for Western civilization. And then you have the commitment to believe it. And then you have these kind of, you know, weird contextual rationales between many, many evangelical groups in the United States who feel that there is some sort of ideological identification with Tel Aviv because it brings forth the end times, etc. So there are a number of reasons, but I think many of them are related to how Tel Aviv has been re-articulated as being a just another city like any other city in the global north. And that kind of whitewashing of its colonial racial present has a lot of commonalities with the whitewashing of colonial racial settlements, which were transformative and intrinsic to the development of the global north.
Okay. So I kind of want to pick up on a couple of things. I think it's been really interesting as someone who obviously studies the far right and alt right to see that actually within the right wing itself, there's been a huge split on this issue, with some right wingers actually being in their own way pro-Palestine. So for example, Candace Owens and Jackson Hinkle and people like this. So just as Gaza has kind of disrupted the left-right spectrum for a lot of people, because it's like, well, hang on a minute, you shouldn't be believing this. I want to kind of go into something a bit more, not serious, but a bit more, what's the word I'm looking for? Established, I guess, an established notion. And that is of the nation state. Okay. So especially many, many years ago, it used to be said to Muslims in Britain, you know, why do you care about Palestinians? You know, you're not Palestinian. You're originally from, you know, Pakistan, Kashmir. Why do you care about this? So what I want to ask you is, how have events in Gaza shown the limitations of the nation state project?
Okay. Let me go back to your question about the split between the right. Now, within the right, there's always been, especially in the United States, a nativist tendency of American isolationism. And that's one element to it. But I wouldn't say that that's a huge split. I think, you know, one can get caught in the kind of personalities of immediate talking heads, which constitute this kind of sphere in which people operate in a way. But fundamentally, what I think you need to look at is the actual discursive configuration around the position of what Tel Aviv represents. So when you look at claims made by white supremacists, what they want is an ethno-state of their own. And when you look at what their template for an ethno-state is, then you come to that conclusion that regardless of the variations, many of those techniques, many of those kind of examples come from what Tel Aviv has been doing for the last 70 plus years. So I think one should be cautious. And this is not just a question about little feuds between these kind of talking heads personalities. Look at, for example, the way practices, policing practices flow across police forces. How the innovation or the training or the kind of laboratory produced by Tel Aviv's occupation end up informing practices in famously places like Ferguson, but you can see in Kashmir, in eastern Turkestan, you know, you can see governments taking this project of constructing an ethnostate. And when I say government, I don't necessarily mean there is one kind of coherent cabinet or a group of mainly men sitting around making decisions. This is at a capillary level. Police departments do not necessarily take direct orders in the United States, for example, but they may have exchange programs and say, well, actually, the people we want to learn from, who have had to deal with the rest of populations, are the people who've been doing the policing in the West Bank, for example. Right? If you look at some of the similarities around child theft, this is something, the scandal in Australia, in Canada, United States, it was a major, major device. Take the children off the native population and then re-educate them. Now, again, there have been glories and apologies, but you see similar kinds of imprisonment of children. So I think we need to move away from the idea of scoring little debating points on podcasts to look at the deeper infrastructural affinities. And I only use deeper as a way of contrasting them, but they go alongside that.
Yeah.
And therefore, I would say to you, to repeat that point again, that really what is the kernel is this. If you believe in an ethnostate, then Tel Aviv is both a laboratory and a horizon, or till at least the 7th of October, as a, this is a way you can build a successful ethnostate, whether you want to build it in Kashmir and the rest of India, whether you want to build it in Burma, whether you want to build it in East Turkestan, etc. So if you believe in an ethnostate, this was a model. Now, in the same way that for a very long time, apartheid South Africa was a model and an aspiration for many, many groups. So the key here is an ethnostate. When it's done within the comforts of white supremacists, they want a white ethnostate. You know, Han chauvinists may want a Han ethnostate. Hinduvada activists may want a Hindu ethnostate. And at the heart of the ethnostate, what it excludes is any kind of subjectivity or identity which potentially, and in perhaps in actuality, doesn't really completely fit into the ethnostate. And this goes to your question about the nation state itself. In the current conjuncture, what you can argue is this, that Muslimness is antithetical to the idea of an ethnostate. Whenever it tries to wrap itself around an ethnostate, it runs into a lot of difficulties and challenges. That doesn't mean that there haven't been ethnostates there, but I would say to you, most of the instances of ethnostate, regardless of what vocabulary that they used, end up coming from what I would call the Kemalist playbook. If you look at the what happened under Saddam in Iraq versus the Kurds, or you could argue what has happened under the Turkish Republic to the Kurdish population, the idea of constructing an ethnostate was always something that emphasized ethnicity over Muslimness. And even, or the ethnicization of Muslimness, that only a people of this ethnicity could be proper Muslims. But this is something that has always been constantly contested. And it is remains true to this day that it is impossible for anyone to claim that they can only, you can only be a Muslim in one country. Or other words, there's only one country that is a Muslim country, or there's only one way of being Muslim in a way. You cannot close Muslimness within the confines of one nation state boundary. That, I think, has been repeated. So the idea of the nation state itself produces problems for the idea of Muslimness, which remains far more open to transnationality even now. And I would argue that perhaps in this conjuncture, it is the main vector for expressing transnationality.
Mm.
Not the only one, but certainly the main one. And that is one of the reasons why nearly all the instances of ethno-nationalist projects in the world today have an element of Islamophobia in them, because Muslimness represents both anti-modernity and the impossibility of closing the ethno-state around the structure of a nation-state or a nationality.
Mm. Okay, so what I want to do is I kind of want to invert the question that I asked, because we've looked at the outside now, we've looked at nation state, we've looked at ethno state, we've looked at basically the Western modernity, as it were. So now, how has what's happened in Gaza shown the limitations of current Muslim leadership?
I think, to be honest with you, you didn't need Gaza to show the current limitations of Muslim leadership.
True.
I mean, it helps. I mean, this is the issue there. But I think it's done two things. And again, I don't think it's exclusively Muslim, but I think one of the things that Gaza has done is intensified what used to be called, in sort of Marxist lexicon, the contradiction between the rulers and the ruled across the world generally.
Mm.
Certainly, you can see, for example, in the global north, it is the elite, the political elite, and with its appendages in cultural the sphere, which is most stridently supporting the assault on Gaza.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's doing this not simply by diplomatic notes, but in material terms. We've seen that. We've seen this. There's arguments being made that without U.S. resupply, there wouldn't be enough. Tel Aviv would not have had enough bombs to kill so many Palestinians in Gaza.
Mm.
So, or for example, you could not stop genocide, but you managed to organize so-called 12-nation coalition in the Red Sea, which is basically, again, includes the usual coalition of the willing, that basically, sort of basically clients of the United States. And I include London in that as well, in this kind of leadership. So the issue about the leadership right now is I think at first is two challenges. The post-1945 model of governance in the global north or in Western, in the West, was based on opposition to the threat of communism on the East. And as part of the opposition was concession to improving welfare rights. So you had welfare democratic states, and within that, different countries, you had a range of options within the left and the right of the political spectrum, which often meant some kind of ideological debate and contestation around certain issues. What you've seen is the kind of collapse of that through neoliberalism, and the neoliberalism has firstly robbed much of the teeth and effectiveness of the welfare order, and now it's moving on to undermining civil and human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a situation where you are seeing the reconfiguration of the Western liberal democracies as plutocracies, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you a small illustration, you've seen the richest and probably the most well-endowed university in the free world, to use that phrase ironically at least, Harvard, basically being forced or certainly encouraged to ditch their first black women president because of pressure from billionaires. Now, if a university whose endowment is already in multi-billions cannot or is not willing to withstand the pressure of billionaire donors, then what is the point of a university's championing of academic freedom? So already you have this. And I think people are saying, look, this is an assault on the university's independence. Now, the reason I talk about the university is not just is because, in a way, that they're always touted as these pinnacle of these liberal institutions, those laboratories of liberal thought where you can think, you know, creatively, and you can think in freedom. And this has always been, this is the difference between totalitarian societies, et cetera, et cetera. But you're seeing that assault. You're seeing, for example, voter registration, not just in the United States, but also in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. You're seeing, which is basically without evidence of significant or any voter fraud, is being instituted as a way of basically making it more and more difficult for groups of people, ethnic minorities mainly, but also and poor, to vote. You have in the introduction on Europe, in most countries in Europe now, a two-tier citizenship. There are those citizens whose citizenship can be removed at the whim of the government of the day, basically. And there are other citizens, regardless of what criminal activity they may engage in, there's no talk about removing their citizenship. Now, when you put all of these things together, it seems to me you have created a situation in which political leadership is no longer responsive to the desire for change in people's well-being. And Gaza exemplifies that because there is repeatedly been shown in countries like the United States and Britain, other places, a major disconnect between public opinion and public policy followed by governments which are supposed to be responsive to public opinion. So that intensification, I think, is happening elsewhere. I think in the Muslim world, Muslim leadership depends on there being some kind of sovereign entities. And in Islamistan, I think it's debatable how many sovereign entities there really are. And I would argue that for at least 30, 40 years now, the dividing line running through Muslim communities around the world is not between moderates and extremists, but really between those who have some kind of accountable rule and those who have only absolute rule. And that absolute rule can take the form of sheikhdoms and presidencies for life, etc. But what it actually negates is that the bargain that you make with the people is that we won't bother you, you don't bother us. Right? And somehow in some places with the oil-rich countries where you have rentier income, you can buy that off. So you get, you know, all the mod cons as long as you don't express any views that challenge the governance. And other places you have basically the security services to do that. And I think this is not just an sometimes it's described as an Arab problem. It's not. If you go to Pakistan, if you go to Bangladesh, if you go to, Central Asia, you'll find a similar kind of challenge. And it nearly in the divide between absolutism and accountability, the key is the role of Muslimness, because you cannot have accountability in Islamistan without there being a space for the expression of Muslimness. Therefore, these two things go in hand, and a kind of Muslimness that is independent of the state authorities is exactly what the accountable governments don't. The accountable governments have no way of controlling, where absolutist governments do want to control that. So there's a convergence between the interests of Tel Aviv, Cairo, and many of the other tyrannies. If you think about who supports Tel Aviv, remember, one of the things Tel Aviv is touted at as being the only democratic country in the region. And the countries which have any kind of democratic accountable presence do not support Tel Aviv. Its most ardent supporters are the most tyrannical regimes in the region, monarchies and life presidencies. So I would say the Muslim leadership at a kind of political level has shown to be at the most technocratic, purveyors of the current status quo. But I think there's also another way you could argue about Muslim leadership, and that's kind of organic Muslim leadership, which has also been shown to be caught on the hoof. And that is partly to do with their inability to think in strategic and political terms about the conditions that confront the Muslim Ummah, and the ability to see these as not random acts of violence and cruelty, but sustained, convergent occurrences which come about through the logic of Islamophobia and its institutionalization in the global war on terror, and how that has become the grammar of the world order.
Okay. You mentioned Muslimness, and I kind of want to pick up on that, because there's been something else that's been kind of being introduced, as it were, into the debate around all of this. And it's the idea of the Palestinization of Muslims. Yeah. And I just want to ask you, what does this actually mean? What are we talking about when we talk about the Palestinization of Muslims?
Well, one way to think of Islamophobia is that it is the Palestinianization of Muslims. And what racial, and the concept of racial Palestinianization was introduced, as far as I know, by David Theo Goldberg a couple of years ago, and looking at the different racial regimes in the world. So, and it was just simply a ideal type, they probably wouldn't use that language, of that. Now, Palestinianization, as we said before, you can see what it means is the reduction of Muslimness to subjugated status with no autonomy and no expression of agency, and simply to kind of their reduction to being colonized, subjugated people. And the Palestine, so if you think about Islamophobia talking about Palestinianization, you can see that, for example, in the previous Radio Reorient podcast, we had a very interesting conversation. I say very interesting because I was involved in it, but my part wasn't interesting, but it was a part where Saul talked about the urban planning in Denmark, which kind of uses similar kinds of techniques around. Now, it doesn't say explicitly this is Islamophobic, but the euphemisms are there, and the urban planning, how you control and regulate spaces, is all explicitly made. So I think there is a sense in which the Palestinianization then becomes an option for Muslims in the first place. But then you can see it spreading, for example, in Ferguson and the policing of African-American and Chicano neighborhoods in the United States. You can see that as a remit, as a basically in a way where you reproduce the system of apartheid for a post-colonial age. You don't call it apartheid. You don't overtly spend, at this point in time, huge amounts of resources in a kind of biologistic racial ideology, but you do everything which replays and plays on that. So Palestinianization is really what, so so like a dispossession. Once the dispossession comes in through kind of legal means, it opens a space for either ethnic cleansing or reservations. It's basically bringing back colonial subjectivities, colonial outcomes for certain demographic groups.
Mm.
Registration, like we talked about voter registration, then can lead on to nationality registration. And once you, you have to prove that you are entitled to vote, and then you can't prove that entitled to vote, you can't prove your nationality. That means you're not entitled to have a state. I mean country rather than a state, but that it means that you are literally become homeless.
Mm.
And therefore you are on sufferance. And you can be expelled. And again, if the Gaza onslaught succeeds, then I would imagine that there are many, many governments and political orientations in the world which will see this as, okay, so this is, we've done this in the with the Rohingya, it was done and no one said anything. Now it's been done in Gaza and no one's saying anything. Then whether we can do this in other places, and India comes close to mind. The 200 million Muslims, the little Pakistans everywhere, and we don't know if they are really citizens or not. They need to demonstrate that. They don't have the paperwork. They lose the paperwork. They lose the right to work. Then you create these kind of, and ultimately the potential of expulsion. In the pursuit of that ethnic state.
So I guess the next question naturally follows from what you've just said. Well, what are the forms of resistance then that we can undertake to all of this? What's the way out, basically?
I mean, look, the forms of resistance are always conditional in the situation that people find themselves in. I think those of us who are involved, in sort of education, one of the things we can do is educate. I think the two most important things are three most important things. So firstly is the demonstrations, which are being regularly held. I think people should attend those demonstrations. They should carry on with those demonstrations. Demonstrations have a number of functions. One, they act as a morale booster. They also act educatively, and they have the impact of actually showing as a demonstration. There is an encouraging those who are the direct targets of that unrelenting violence that there are people who care, and we're holding these people who've enabled genocide to account. So there's a kind of a testimonial role to demonstrations, an educative role to demonstrations, and there's a kind of a morale and building role to demonstrations. And I think it's really, really important to do that. I think part of that, then the second part of that, and this is not in order of significance, is shifting the narrative, which has moved from a very pro-ultra-Zionist position to a more critical position, and we need to build on that, and critical of the anti-Semitic version of ultra-Zionism, which we call ultra-Zionism, which is the total identification of every person of Jewish heritage and descent with the actions of Tel Aviv. And that is basically said that is, and the confusion comes in constantly that opposition to Tel Aviv is not an opposition to Judaism and it's not an opposition to Jewishness. And that has really been important, and we need to build on that. And to argue otherwise is anti-Semitic, because it not only does it deny the diversity in Jewishness itself, but it also says that this is how Jewishness represents itself through that kind of violence, through that kind of cruelty, through that kind of injustice. So that part of the narrative is to continue, and you do that narrative by shifting that narrative by writing, speaking, talking constantly on that. And one of the difficulties, the kind of pro-Palestinian position has, is the fact that most of the vectors where this can be done are not open to this type of debate, but still it is possible to impact upon them and transform them. And I think this is already happening. So you get into this situation where you get people who are made famous by their claim that facts don't care about their feelings, but then when their feelings come into it, facts do care about their feelings, their own feelings. So I think that shows that, again, the kind of subjectivity which they have denied, the kind of behind that, you know, claims of we are doing objective facts. Well, no, you're not. You're doing basically, you know, it's just another argument for the construction of knowledge rather than knowledge as being something discovered out there, lying out there. So that's the third part, I think, is the shifting of the narrative. And I think around that, the third part, I think, is taking action by petitioning. And these petitions can take the form of BDS movement, defending that, supporting that, extending that. Because as you know, in many parts of the world, and there is a pressure to try and make that illegal. And again, the importance of boycotts need to be expanded, because boycotts are a way of expressing freedom of expression. It's a way of supporting your civil rights. So why should you support cruelty and injustice? And I think, you know, it's important that many of these major corporations, you know, whether they are in kind of selling hamburgers or selling degrees, are involved in making two different claims. They want to be inclusive because they say that they are feeding the world or teaching the world, and they want to be global. But at the same time, their globality, it runs into challenges, and their commitment to equality and diversity runs into challenges when they're shown directly to be supporting ethnic cleansing in all kinds of places. So I think it's holding that to account. So I think that the third thing is the petitioning, and that means, like I said, it means BDS, it means writing to legislators where it's possible to do so, it means putting constantly holding to account organizations, institutions, and individuals for what they are doing and enabling. Now, these, I think, are the kind of range of things that people can do where there is capacity to do that. And certainly in the those kinds of mobilizations are really, really important to do that. And we've seen, for example, you know, we've seen extraordinarily a number of Latin American countries downgrade their diplomatic relations. We've seen South Africa take Tel Aviv to the court of the International Court, Criminal Court for genocide. And we would welcome those kinds of issues and claims, because also it again shows that kind of international legal order built after 1945 and fully monopolized by the West after 1989 is now being used in a way that Washington and Paris and London never thought could be used, because they always thought fundamentally they're always on the right side of history. So you will see this is, you know, the debates around trying to abandon human rights legislation and circumvent international legal frameworks that are coming in. So at the heart of Gaza's struggle is the difficult birth of a new, more inclusive sense of the universal expressed through the need for minimum of claims of civil rights for humans, for humanity. And the challenge is that without that, you're going to move into a far more contested and violent phase of the world. So in a sense, what is Gaza is about is really about preserving some mechanisms for trying to domesticate the arbitrary exercise of violence. And most people, most of the time, unless they're complete psychopaths, would probably want that to be a good thing. And that's what I think we should understand the Gaza struggle for.
Right. Thank you very much for that, Professor Said.
Thank you, sir.
This has been an episode of Radio Reorient, brought to you by Network Reorient, part of the Critical Muslim Studies Project. Your host has been Hiza Mir, and the episode has been sound engineered by Zubair Vakil. Thank you for tuning in. Have a listen to our other episodes, and please leave a like and a rating.